minutes to talk about Black Lives Matter. I'm pretty sure everyone is eager to hear about it. I would just like to frame it as a black person coming from the United States. We have a lot of intellectuals that are probably not recognized internationally, maybe they are, but I would always like to first start by acknowledging our ancestors, being those slaves who have built the country of the United States and built many countries, being our Aboriginal brothers and sisters who are still going through genocide, or my ancestors that are no longer with us. So first, I'm going to say peace upon them. A little nerves, it's okay. So I'd like to start by saying a quote by James Baldwin. He said, to be a Negro in this country and to be relatively conscious is to be in a rage almost all the time. And so as we look at the Black Lives Matter movement, a lot of us see a lot of young, angry people, right? You see these people willing to stop traffic in a way. A lot of times across the world, we see highways shut down, streets, trains. And a lot of questions arise, right? With this anger, what are you gonna do with it? And I think that's the best question, right? But I don't believe that it's posed at the right set of people. And so if you have a segment of the population, just looking at some small statistics saying that over 55% of the world are people that's 25 years or younger, meaning that the changing of the world is up to almost 55% of the people, that within a decade, all these people will be in some kind of form of power, right? They'll be in college, they'll be in parliament, they'll be in Congress. The powers that be is forever changing. So the question really is to the powers that be, what are you going to do with all this anger that's outside in the streets? A lot of this anger comes out of a place called Ferguson, Missouri. It's a place where I grew up. It's 8 minutes from my house. Before Ferguson happened, the killing of Mike Brown on August 9th, 2014, most people would say Ferguson was a nice place to live. It's a middle class, middle working class black community. This black community was 2/3 of the population. The median income was over $35,000 a year. People were laying, these black people were first working in industries around automotive skills, now getting into tech and retail. But what we've seen time and time again is that a changing in not only American politics, but a changing in American capitalism has removed these people from being not only homeowners, but now renters. And so as we look at the crash of 2008, really a global recession, we're looking at a changing global environment. I truly believe that what happened in Ferguson was an international issue. I was one of few members to actually have a conversation with international members to send a delegation to the United Nations on the behalf of not only black people in America, but black people everywhere. Our charge was genocide. It seems that no matter where you are in the world, if you have this color skin, you're at the bottom of the class struggle. So I always come back to a few questions for me. It really comes back to fundamental change. I listened to Stan Grant. He was very profound in his thoughts. I've really never heard such grievances conveyed and framed in a way intellectually. And it made me proud to even share the podium with him. And he actually left me to really tinker with my conversation piece today. And so he left me with a couple thoughts that I not only want to leave myself to answer, but everyone in the audience. And so he spoke of the greatness of a constitution. As we look at a constitution, no matter where it is, its foundation supposed to lead us, not only in basic human rights, but in social change and basic social ramifications. Amnesty International describes human rights as basic principles. Let me make sure I say it right, because I know I have some people from Amnesty here right now. Amnesty describes human rights as human rights are the basic freedoms and protections that belong to every single one of us. And so if you look at the American Constitution, you look at life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But staying framed in a way that really left me to ask the question that most poor people, working class people, be it black, brown, white, or whoever, is asking is, what good is a constitution if it's not applied? And so what good is this piece of paper? So as we have these celebrations, and Frederick Douglass would always say, no matter how Americans celebrate the 4th of July, which is our independence in 1776, he asked the question, what is July 4th or what is Independence Day to the Negro? On this day in history in 1776, my ancestors were slaves. And so as the forefathers celebrated the Emancipation Proclamation, as fireworks went off, as they had a great feast and time again, and years that followed, it took up until 1865 for my people to finally get free. That came through the Emancipation Proclamation. That came through Abraham Lincoln. But then again, Frederick Douglass asked this quintessential question, and I think everyone that's of color, or anybody who's in parliament or who are thinking about change, be it a black person, a white person, conservative or liberal, I know that has a different meaning here, or labor, is that what to do with these 4 million Negroes? And he asked the question of basically, what to do with these newly freed individuals? And so if you look at Aboriginal people, when the Constitution came, they also were enslaved. Not in the American lexicon, but in a way that left them out, that left them always behind. And so I continue to ask these questions to say, when we have to go into the system, because we have to, because we live inside of a community, which is called a country. Now I want to be clear that we need to stop drawing these artificial lines. Because as we look at xenophobia, right? And we can call it Islamophobia, but it's really xenophobia. And so we always have to look at it in an honest way to say, what terms do we set for this treaty that Australia does not have? What terms should we set? And matter of fact, who should be setting that? Because most of us come from an indigenous background where in which there's no true just king or queen. There's no real power structure that way. And that it's a collective decision to go out and protect yourself, to build a house, or to feed your family. Well, y'all with me out there? I just want to make sure. I see, I don't want y'all to fall asleep after that. So as I look at things, I always have to quote some of the great philosophers, right? The greatest philosopher of any young black person I've ever known is Tupac Shakur. Tupac Shakur, he says something in a rap song. It's really weird describing rap as if it's some deep philosophy to academics and intellectuals, but to poor working class black people around the world, we know that this culture, this rap, this hip hop thing really influences the world and the consciousness of the movement. And so he said, Tupac says, when it rains, it pours. Right? He said, they have money. Hold on, I'm sorry. I'm getting nervous. It's a lot. I tried to prepare my best. In actuality, I think I've overprepared. I'm gonna come back to that, I'm sorry. So, I can't hear you. Yes, there we go. I'm sorry. Thank God for that. You say when it rains, it pours. Help me out again. We have money for wars, but we can't feed the poor. And he goes on to really say, we have no hope for the future, which really means we have no hope for the youth, which means we have no hope for the future. And so what you're seeing across this world is young people being in sub-Saharan Africa, rising up in Burkina Faso with the Congo. What you're seeing in the streets of Ferguson, Baltimore. And what I saw Sunday in Melbourne and across Australia is young black people actually politicized in a way that most people cannot fully understand. Is that almost through osmosis, black people, find out what is their political and social economic role in society. And so when we go through these schools and we look at our own schools, being in a remote place, a remote rural town in Mississippi, a remote town in Australia, what we're seeing is people who are not being educated for the system, who's being disenfranchised, I believe, purposely. People want to criticize and say, well, maybe the system is broken. I am not a person who believes the system is broken. I believe it is functioning exactly as it was designed. It was designed to keep people out of the system. And so when we ask for the terms of the treaty, what is it for the left or the right, for the settlers or the descendants of the settlers or those who benefit the most from it? What is the benefit for them to come to the table to negotiate and compromise? As we see in the world, I honestly believe that their point, I mean not their point, but their position to come to the table is ultimately up to, do you want society to thrive, survive, or perish? A Black Lives Matter movement only comes about through a radical Dr. King. And so as we see Dr. King pre-65, he was playing in the parameters of not only a national legal confine, but he was playing inside of a legal construct that did not fully represent black people. And so when you saw Ferguson, Missouri, it did not look like the America that you see on your TV. It looked somewhere like a war zone. Ferguson looked like Fallujah. It looked like a place in the Congo. And it may not be bombs, right? It may not look like what you might see in Iraq, but I want to tell you that Ferguson is the beginning of somewhere like Iraq. And that they did not start just dropping bombs one day, right? One day they started with repressing the people who were always oppressed. And that their permanent status of oppression being tested by the most weakest and most marginalized had to be responded to in a heavy-handed way. And so what you saw was tanks, tear gas, MRAPs, rubber bullets, things that you may not have seen on the TV where drones were flying over our head. And so in astonishment, we continue to come outside. And in astonishment to black poor people who have voted time and time again. In 2008 for Barack Obama, we showed up again historically in 2012. We are astonished to see Obama did not speak to the grievances of poor black people. And that droves of black people who came outside to vote for him was left no different from how George Bush left black poor people in Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. No different from how Barack Obama leaves his East African brothers and sisters in Eritrea and Ethiopia to starve to death. I don't want to come here to be so harsh like I was on the radio this week. I just want to say that while we are dying in the street, my question ultimately lies, be it in the liberals and the progressives and those who call themselves the left, to say, where will you stand up? This question is troubling to me, because as we need more voters are being incarcerated in the United States of America. As we're asking people to come out and work through this problem, I believe this problem is not a problem that we can just pray through, give charity to, or vote through. Because time and time again, what we've seen is the right mobilized, and they speak out in such strong and harsh language, and it seems that they're conservatives in the core. And what are they conservative? The foundation of this country, be it America or Australia, gerrymandered districts and disenfranchised voters, poverty in remote areas, poor and failing health care if you're a person of color. They are conservatives, but my problem always lies with the liberals. Because as the liberals is always slow to respond in real time to our cries. Always. And so as we look to Kennedy and whoever else, and Obama and Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, be it progressive or liberal or left or soft left or hard left, poor working class black and brown people are dying. So my question always comes back to, what are we gonna do? And we have to act. And so I have a quote. I'm not gonna mess this quote up, I promise, and I'll be done. It came at the founding of our country. And that our country, ultimately, leaders and founding father, Thomas Jefferson, almost knew what was going on. He seen the tyranny show up, and he was sure that it may come again. And so he looked in the halls and all these meetings, and he said, these people are not to be trusted. And so Thomas Jefferson says, when in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one person to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and nature of God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that we should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I know everyone heard that. That they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are to institute among men, deriving their just powers in the consent of the governed. That whenever a form of government becomes destructive of its ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying on its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to the effect of safety and happiness. It is our right. It is our duty. It is our duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for this future security. So when you see Black Lives Matter, if we're marching, if we're chanting, if we're screaming, if we're shutting down a train, a highway, if it's your school building, if it's Parliament or the Senate, it is our duty to abolish it if it is not working for the people. Thank you.
So we'll take some questions now for Tori. And I remind you that there are some wonderful consent interns floating around with microphones, and that would be helpful if you want to speak to the microphone. But first of all, as promised, we're going to take our first question from Twitter. And if I get to my phone. Okay, for a question, sorry. These problems are not new, as you've already indicated. Why has a movement like Black Lives Matter caught on now?
I think that we're seeing it outside. These issues are not new. I think that it's just visible to the people who it didn't affect. And so more and more often, more and more times, be it mainstream media, be it on our social media feeds, we're seeing black death. And we're seeing black death at some of the highest rates that we've ever seen. And so as people start to scream and howl and cry out in the streets more and more often, the movement became political, gained visibility, and hopefully it will be in a position to actually bring change.
Thank you. Hello. Yeah. Thank you, Tori. My name is Anala Cooper. I'm the Yarra woman of Kimberley and Broome. And as an Aboriginal woman, I'm very aware that my appearance does not fit many Australians' idea of what an Aboriginal person should look like. I'm also very conscious of my privilege as a person of colour who has light skin. I have family in Miami, and recently we've been talking to them about a visit, about us going to Miami to visit. And I'm actually a bit scared about going there. When I said I was scared, they asked why, and I said, well, they're killing black people in the street for no reason. They're killing brown people, and it makes me scared. And then I thought, maybe I don't have a right to be scared, because I have been to a country over half a dozen times, and I've always felt safe. Originally, my question to you was going to be about fear and anger, but I'd rather ask you, as a black man in America, how you have seen resilience and strength among the black community rise or not recently?
I want to speak to your fear too. And so as we march in the streets, I'm not going to lie to you, I'm afraid too. I'm afraid that someone may shoot. I see neo-Nazis in Australia. I didn't think that was going to happen. I didn't think it was neo-Nazis here, but I knew it was racist here. And so, you know, I really gained my strength. You know, I would say, like most black people, people of color, the strongest person I know is a black woman. And so I also want to get my strength from my mother and all the black mothers who had to be psychically strong, you know? As we look at the movement, we have to draw our strength, but also empower our women. And so if it wasn't for strong black women marching with me in the streets, and strong black women staying at home, taking care of the kids, and strong black women who just can't get off work because they make less than men, that's why I draw my strength.
Framework. And so there's a spectrum between civil disobedience all the way through to wondering if you have any thoughts on where the situation is in that spectrum.
It's my position as a leader and an organizer, or as a conscious person. I would have to remind people there were two kings, and so there were pre-65 king that were dead in the jail as he tried to appeal to America. And it was a king who worked on what I would call economic or political economic revolution. And so as he was killed actually organizing black, brown, and poor white people and Native Americans to sit out and sit on the lawn of the White House and the Poor People's Campaign. And so economically, we know that right now it's 100 million people in the United States of America who do not make $15 an hour. And if we can organize those people in the same way King can, I think we can have a revolution. I think ultimately Jefferson was in a position that black people or Aboriginal people are not in. We don't have mass amounts of guns or money. And so his revolution is all ultimately really dictated on how well the paperwork looks and how big and fast he can pull his gun. While ours is always based on the civil rights. And I always try to say that black people, the most powerful thing we did for the United States of America was civilize it. And that's why we call it the civil rights. And so our revolution will have a radical liberation theology. And we will not lose our moral compass through guns or blood. We will have it in our hearts, and we believe in that.
Hi, my name's Anne. I'm really honored to have you here and listen to everything you have to say. I'm half American, and so I follow what's happening overseas really closely, and it's really deeply troubling for me and my identity. I've been reading a textbook called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, and it was written in the early 90s by a group of women of colour called Insight. And I suppose I'm working in the not-for-profit sector, and so it's really made me reflect upon the role that the not-for-profit sector and the way that money is controlled in that area in a way that shuts out radical activists. And so I would be really interested to hear your thoughts on that, especially given that we are in a room full of people who work in a part of the not-for-profit industry.
I mean, so last night I sat in a room full of organizers and activists from here, and they said exactly that, is that they can't find $5,000 or $10,000 to organize for a calendar year. I don't really know how you obtain that other than you have to look inside yourself and look inside the people. There will be no funding, you're right. There will be funding as long as it looks pretty to the funders. But we know that philanthropy or charity is not always going to be the solution. I mean, we can look at Chad, which Chad, I believe, receives the most amount of foreign aid, charity, and philanthropy money in the world, but still is poor. And so we need mechanisms, be it agriculture, that's autonomous from the nonprofit sector. And if you're really a radical person in the nonprofit sector, you would write a check for what they have or what they need, and you would just move on. You would leave us to our own accord.
Thank you. Hi. My name's Tom, I've just come back from the US as well. And what I noticed was I just want to talk about Unicom, maybe the inherently problematic emergence of the All Lives Matter campaign, what that does to divert attention and disrupt the movement or trajectory of the Black Lives Matter movement.
I don't think it distracts. I think it, to me, it makes it very clear who's the covert racists are. And so a lot of my white liberal friends like to say all lives matter. A lot of our, you know, black people who are singing Kumbaya like to say all lives matter. I think If all lives mattered, then there would be no genocide. All right? There would be no mass incarceration, no school to prison pipeline. The youth unemployment rate, I believe, is somewhere around 1 in 4, 1 in 5 in northern parts of Australia. And so if you're looking at youth unemployment, if you're looking at housing and healthcare discrepancies and killings in police custody just here in Australia, I would ask in the application of the hashtag that is stated as all lives really matter. And we know. People of color to make more money and not actually affect change in the power dynamics.